This is Radio Moscow. Good evening, everybody. We are broadcasting on 17.83, 15.23, 15.17, 11.89, and 11.88 megacycles per second. Two of these frequencies are dropped at 7:30 Eastern Standard Time, and we continue broadcasting until 7:50 on 17.83, 15.17, and 11.89 megacycles per second. Here is our program for this evening. The news, a discussion written by academician Tarley, the Soviet Union, a world power. Then comes Moscow Newsreel with an actuality recording from a factory library in Moscow. The sidelights on Soviet life program which follows is devoted to the Russian Federation, the largest of the Soviet republics. Then there's our weekly feature, Notes on Soviet Culture, and 7:30 brings the news again and the commentary. The transmission ends at 8:10 with the Soviet anthem. This is Radio Moscow, and here's the news. The Political Committee of the United Nations General Assembly has been discussing the Greek problem for 2 weeks. This discussion has fully revealed how groundless is the stand adopted by the American delegation. The American delegation and its solicitors have failed to prove either the totally unsubstantiated charges they leveled at the northern neighbors of Greece, or to refute the extensive evidence of crass Anglo-American intervention in Greek affairs, submitted to the committee by the representatives of the Soviet Union and a number of other countries. No wonder Mr. Herschel Johnson, the American delegate, has declared that his delegation is ready to drop the charges against Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, and Albania, provided those countries agree to the setting up of a so-called frontier commission. This frontier commission, in the attention of its initiators, would serve as a screen for ever-increasing Anglo-American interference in the domestic affairs of Greece. This talk about an ostensible compromise was begun in order to somewhat weaken the impression created by the unsuccessful attacks of American diplomacy on Greece's northern neighbors. Another purpose it pursued was to secure, under cover of what is to seem a compromise, to secure a decision on setting up the Frontier Commission, which the Americans need to carry out their expansionist plans. The maneuvers of the American delegations were completely exposed by Soviet delegate Vyshinsky in his speech in the Political Committee on Monday. This speech is regarded in assembly circles as the highlight of the whole debate on the Greek problem. In his brilliant speech, supported by weighty arguments, Vyshinsky subjected to an extensive analysis the report of the Committee of Investigation into the situation on the northern frontiers of Greece, the report of its auxiliary group, as well as the speeches of the American, British, French, Belgian, and several other delegates. Vyshinsky completely upset the groundless charges leveled against the northern neighbors of Greece. At the same time, he proved irrefutably that the United States and Great Britain were interfering in Greek affairs. Demonstrating that the talk about a so-called compromise solution was merely a ruse, Vyshinsky insisted on a just settlement of the Greek case. The basis for such a settlement, for such a just settlement, could only be the withdrawal from Greece of foreign troops and of all the military and other experts interfering in the internal affairs of Greece and turning that country into an American military vantage ground. At Monday's meeting of the Political Committee, the delegations of the United States and Great Britain mobilized the representatives of three British dominions, Australia, the Union of South Africa, and Canada, to support their stand. The Australian delegate, Evatt, insisted stubbornly that the committee should not go into the essence of the matter on hand, but should merely take for gospel the conclusion of the majority of the Committee of Investigation and automatically endorse the decision in the spirit of that conclusion. Dr. Evatt mustered all his eloquence to whitewash the United States and Great Britain, who are guilty of gross interference in Greek affairs. All those present noticed an interesting detail. As soon as Evatt finished his speech, He made straight for Mr. Dulles of the American delegation with the obvious intention of learning what impression his speech had produced. Dulles patted the Australian minister on the back. It must be said that the South African and Canadian delegates in defending the Anglo-American case did not venture to support the original draft of the American resolution and expressed themselves in favor of the American draft being accepted with the French amendment. Committee number two for economic and financial matters on Monday continued to discuss the report of the Economic and Social Council. The Yugoslav delegate Zilfan described the heroism with which his people were successfully rehabilitating the war-ravaged national economy of Yugoslavia. This progress in rehabilitation, Zilfan said, proves that despite the ominous predictions made in certain quarters in connection with the cessation of American aid to Yugoslavia, production and commodity exchange in Yugoslavia had not diminished and the financial system was as stable as ever. Zilfan correctly criticized the work of the Economic and Social Council, which had not checked the attempts of certain economically aggressive powers to act not only outside the framework of UNO, but in violation of the organization's principles. We know nothing about the terms of the Marshall Plan, Zilfan said, but we do know on what conditions Greece and Turkey are receiving aid. These countries have been granted loans on terms which are incompatible with their sovereignty. The Trusteeship Committee on Monday continued its general debate on the report of the Special Committee for the Non-Self-Governing Territories. The Ukrainian delegate Voina pointed out that the representatives of the colonial powers objected to submitting political information in regard to the non-self-governing territories because they wanted to prevent UNO from obtaining full and unbiased information about those territories. The Ukrainian delegate sharply criticized the speech of the British representative, who had tried to praise the policy of colonization and depict the colonial powers as the altruistic benefactors of the colonial peoples. If everything said here corresponded to the truth, the Ukrainian delegate said, surely none of the peoples of the British Empire would be aspiring for independence as persistently as is indeed the case. The Belarusian delegate Shmigov also criticized the speech of the British delegate, who had defended the need for preserving the colonial system. The USSR representative Stein, in his speech, showed how unfounded were the references of the representatives of the colonial powers to the United Nations Charter, references designed to escape from supplying information on the non-self-governing territories. You are listening to Radio Moscow. We continue with some items of Soviet news. 18,000 farmers' households in Soviet Estonia have this year received more than 9 million rubles in government loans for housing construction. In the Viruma district, where the retreating Germans burned down many houses, most of the inhabitants have already moved into new homes. Approximately 1,000 houses have been rehabilitated and built anew in the district of Tartu. It will be 5 years tomorrow since the death of academician Sergei Chaplygin, an outstanding Soviet scientist and public figure. As one of the disciples and associates of Nikolai Zhukovsky, known as the father of Russian aviation, Chaplygin contributed to the development of Soviet aviation. His brilliant discoveries in the realm of hydro and aerodynamics won him worldwide recognition. One of Chaplygin's early papers, his doctor's thesis on gas streams, advanced him to the front ranks of science. The importance of Chaplygin's investigation has received graphic illustration in our day with the development of high-speed aircraft. Chaplygin's paper was in the center of attention at the International Congress of Mechanics in Rome in 1935, and since then is considered a classic work on gas dynamics. Chaplygin devoted more than 30 years to the study of problems pertaining to aviation. He was one of the founders of theoretical aerodynamics. His classic investigations in the theory of the wing have been of great assistance to aircraft designers and have made possible the creation of powerful and swift airplanes. The Soviet government paid high tribute to the scientist, who was decorated with several orders of the USSR and awarded the title of Hero of Socialist Labor. The Pechatny Dvor printing shop in Leningrad is 120 years old. On the eve of its anniversary, it completed its yearly production plan. During 9 months, the printing shop turned out 45 million books and pamphlets, which is 15 million more than during the last year before the war. And that ends this news bulletin, which came to you from Radio Moscow. We follow now with a discussion about the Soviet Union as a world power, written by Academician Tarle, the historian. Here is what Academician Tarle writes.
In the light of the events witnessed by our generation, the 1917 October Revolution, whose 30th anniversary we are approaching, eclipses all the historical upheavals mankind has gone through down the ages. Today, when the Soviet Union, before the eyes of the whole world, has saved Europe and Asia from the danger of a German enslavement, when not only in Europe and Asia, but all over the globe, the USSR is the principal bulwark of hope and hope of all who are bent on rebuffing world fascism and reactionary aggression, once again active today, it is highly instructive to recall the early days of Soviet power and to compare that time with the present. Seldom did the helmsman of bourgeois diplomacy display such mental and moral feebleness, such hopeless mediocrity, such crass ignorance, and so limited an outlook as in the days when the Soviet Revolution began its victorious march, the days when Soviet power first came into existence and began to gain strength. It goes without saying that a desire to strangle Soviet Russia was their uppermost urge. This was not at all surprising, for it would plainly have been naive to expect the capitalist world and its official representatives to look upon the newly born socialist system with anything but unconcealed hostility. What was amazing was the enemy's inability to understand either the scope or the real meaning of our victory in October 1917. To strangle the revolution, what could have been easier in their opinion? It was all a question of not allowing rival countries to grab the booty in this profitable operation of occupying Soviet Russia, an operation which, in their opinion, was really child's play. But time sped on, and it became clearer every year that the Soviet system had taken deep root among the peoples inhabiting the vast territory of the country. Every effort to overthrow Soviet power had clearly failed disgracefully. The birth of Hitler's Third Reich was hailed in the American, British, and French press for the very reason that the whole foreign policy of the Nazi gang was inspired by the unconcealed goal of attacking the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was invaded by the German robber hordes, and the very first victories of the Nazis on the Soviet front were taken to be the herald of the final defeat of the USSR once and for all. All the monstrous atrocities of the German army, their incredible torture of peaceful civilians, were, in the opinion of the most widely circulated newspapers of Europe and America, direct confirmation of the notorious aphorism of Goebbels, "There will be no Russian revenge, for there will be no Russians." And then slowly the scales fell from the eyes of humanity, and in amazement people beheld the contours of the colossal events emerging from the dimness. It was the bursting of a bubble, a legend which had been hammered into the mind 24 years in succession. It was a transition from absurd fascist concoctions to an acknowledgement of reality, a striking reality, and it dawned gradually during the defeat of the Germans at Moscow, then at Stalingrad, at Kursk, and Korsun-Shevchenkova, finally at the ruins of the Imperial Chancellery, where the contemptible reptile breathed its last. In Europe and America, where in 1941 speculation had been rife as to how long the Soviets would be able to resist, 2 months or three, the astounding victories of the Soviet army created the impression of a thunderbolt. It is hardly necessary to explain that today the British, American, and French reactionary press is extolling Anglo-Saxon aid and its decisive influence on our victory only for the benefit of the Philistine, the plebeian reader. Long before the exposures of Elliot Roosevelt and the appearance of other confessions and evidence It was no secret that Allied assistance had been but a drop in the bucket compared to what the Soviet Army had needed and what it had received from Soviet industry and Soviet farms. As to the tardy landing on the Channel coast in the summer of 1944, this was a measure designed not so much to help the Soviet Union as to prevent the Soviet Army from advancing too rapidly to the west. What had happened? A country which had sustained immense losses in the First World War, which had effectuated a sweeping revolutionary breakup, and had created a totally new social and state order despite the stubborn resistance of domestic and foreign enemies. That country had been invaded once again, this time by the ruthless Nazi hordes with the whole continent of Europe behind them. And the country where the socialist system was born in struggle, where the new had been victorious over the old, the country which had eliminated every possibility of a fifth column, that country succeeded in accomplishing what no other country or group of countries had been able to do. It broke the backbone of the German fascist beast and vanquished the militarist power which had terrorized Europe for decades. "Industry on wheels," wrote Laval's minions in the French newspapers, referring to the transfer of Soviet plants and factories to the Urals. And this industry on wheels succeeded in defeating the ensconced industry of the European continent, which worked three shifts a day all through the war for Hitler and his bandit hordes. The Red Army, in liberating the countries of Europe from the Brown Plague, at the same time tore asunder fetters which had been forged during centuries. The would-be rulers fled in panic before its victorious advance. Slogans of social and political emancipation were inscribed on the banner of the Soviet Union. And just as in the history of warfare, neither Caen nor Sedan could compare with Stalingrad, Korsun-Shevchenkova, or the capture of Berlin, so the history of mankind had no case on record of a victor thinking not of booty or vengeance, but of freeing the defeated people from social oppression and exploitation. Looking back today over the 2.5 years that have elapsed since the war, we see how all-important and beneficial this role of the Soviet Union has been. The Soviet Union is a mighty bulwark of world progress and the most trustworthy champion of all the freedom-loving nations of Europe, whom the Anglo-American reactionaries are constantly threatening. For the freedom-loving nations of Europe are being threatened with trouble and civil war, and like Greece, with the forcible reinstatement of such genuine democrats as Soldaris, Zervas, Maniu, Burkamarovsky, and their ilk. The peoples of Eastern Europe, Slav and non-Slav, are becoming closer and closer friends and are establishing stronger and stronger ties with the only great power whose very existence protects them from sharing the fate of the Greeks, Spaniards, or Indonesians. Nor does the significance of the Soviet Union to the world stop there. The great socialist power is indeed a palladium protecting not only the democracy and independence of a number of small and middle-sized powers, but also standing guard over international peace. And this is today no easy task. America, Asia, and Europe are living in the unhealthy and dangerous atmosphere of incessant provocations, each bolder than its predecessor and of artificially engineered incidents. The money bags are under the temporary illusion of being invincible. They believe that if they puff and puff enough, they'll blow the house down. Their chauvinism and national vanity knows no bounds, and they are thundering, verbally so far, against the granite wall they see towering before them. This fall, our people are celebrating two anniversaries, 800 years since the foundation of Moscow, our capital, and 30 years of Soviet power. How many thrilling comparisons come to mind? How many thoughts flash across the memory engendered by these dates? The 11th-century-old history of our country knows of many instances when Russian might had a profound influence on the destinies of Europe. There were generations which, together with Byron, acknowledged that the sunset which lit up Moscow as Napoleon looked down on the city from Poklonnaya Hill ushered in the conqueror's decline, while the flames of the Moscow fire melted the emperor's crown and set Europe free. The Greek Socialist Revolution not only multiplied the former might of the Russian state and did away with its backwardness, It also placed this new and titanic power at the service of humanity's social, political, and cultural progress. It is almost impossible to embrace in space or time the consequences of this most radical upheaval of all and its effect on international relations today and in the days to come. The history of the world has taken such a course that the Soviet world power is today the mainstay of democracy. All over the world today, the Moscow Kremlin and the great power whose heart and brain it is are associated with the struggle for peace and for the social progress of mankind. You've been listening to a discussion written by academician Tarley, the noted historian. This is Radio Moscow calling on 17.83, 15.23, 15.17, 11.89, and 11.88 megacycles. News from the Soviet Union, presented by Moscow Newsreel. Today's program refers to the trial in Belgrade of the former leader of the Peasant Party, charged with espionage and treason. It also touches on two aspects of life here in the Soviet Union. 4 million farmers in the Nazi-wrecked areas have got new houses, and a Moscow factory celebrates its library's 15th birthday. Early in October, the former leader of the Yugoslav Peasant Party, Jovanovic, and his associate Gaji, were brought before the Belgrade court, charged with treason and espionage. As the trial proceeded, an ugly picture of treachery unfolded, familiar to the public from the trials of Mikhailovich and other played-out leaders of reaction. Observer Bill O'Conn presents for you the details that were brought to light at the trial.
During the Nazi occupation, Jovanovich collaborated with Mikhailovich in combating the National Liberation Movement. After Yugoslavia was freed, Jovanovich, under the pressure of the rank-and-file members of his party, joined the People's Front, where he immediately began to sow discord and confusion. But he didn't succeed, for the mass of the peasantry did not follow him. It was at this juncture that the foreign enemies of democratic Yugoslavia came to his aid, and his foreign friends gave him generous support. Faced with a charge, he's twisting and turning and just plainly denying the obvious. But he's being undone by his accomplice, Gaji, who has admitted his guilt. Gaji told the court that as far back as 1942, he'd been recruited as an agent of the intelligence service by the notorious Watson Jr. He admitted that Jovanovich had got his instructions for whipping together the reactionary underground from Clissold, the former press attaché of the British Embassy in Belgrade. It was from him the conspirators had got instructions on activating the underground, on undermining the authority of the People's Front, on carrying on sabotage, and so on. On October the 3rd, a representative of the British Foreign Office tried to refute the charge of interference in the internal affairs of Yugoslavia. He blandly said that Clissold was bound to exhibit the liveliest interest in the internal affairs of the Yugoslavs, and that in such a charming country as Yugoslavia, the press attaché could hardly be wearied by the domestic situation. We don't know whether the British press attaché in Belgrade was wearied, but Mr. Clissold, with his peculiar interest in purely domestic affairs, so quickly wearied the Yugoslavs that the too zealous intelligence man was soon asked to leave the country. Following the usual tactic of putting the blame on the victim, the Foreign Office official declared that any foreigner is ignored in Yugoslavia, and that that strikes at the roots of friendship between Britain and Yugoslavia. Evidently, by the roots of friendship is meant espionage, the organization of a reactionary underground and of sabotage and wrecking. Truly, the traditional conception of friendship the imperialists have for nations upholding their liberty and independence against the designs of foreign powers. our British apologist deliberately distorts the truth, and like a smart Labour Party demagogue, substitutes one conception for another. There is not and cannot be enmity between the British and Yugoslav peoples, although Labour leaders in their eager service to Anglo-American imperialism are doing their best to kindle it. The Yugoslavs, who, like the other Slav peoples, are renowned for their hospitality, gladly welcome all who offer friendship and good faith. As for friends from the intelligence diplomatic service, or the highly placed patrons of Jovanovich, Mikhailovich, and their ilk, to them, the peoples of free Yugoslavia, masters in their own home, very reasonably say, "Gentlemen, your room is preferable to your company."
Here in the Soviet Union, it's been announced that 4 million collective farmers in the war-ravaged districts of the Russian Federation have moved into new homes. In an interview with the head of the Republic's Rural Building Board, our reporter was able to get an idea of the uphill work that's gone into making building in the countryside a success.
Let me etch in the background. The war, the Germans occupying vast stretches of territory, the partisans fighting back, the Nazis taking reprisals by burning down villages wholesale and then completing their work of destruction as the Soviet armies drove them out. It was scorched earth they left behind them, 1,017,000 houses razed to the ground in the Russian Federative Republic alone. Over 1 million farm buildings and 30,000 schools and hospitals shared the same fate. The farms devastated, the collective farmers homeless, living as best they could in dugouts. That was the position that faced the government as soon as the Soviet armies began their long advance from Stalingrad to Berlin. And although the war effort was at its height, the government, as early as August 1943, laid down emergency measures for rehabilitating the liberated areas. The government of the Russian Federation set up a special board to superintend rural and collective farm building. The board gave the lead to the local Soviets, or rural councils, and building organizations, with the priority task of getting our collective farmers out of the dugouts into decent homes. The government put rural housing well up on the priority list for building materials. 10 million cubic yards of timber was allocated. Building loans amounting to 500,000 rubles, on the average 10,000 to a family, to be repaid over 7 years, were granted to the farmers. Families of servicemen or war invalids and very hard-pressed families were given building materials free of charge. Timber flowed out to the devastated areas. The farmers and the local Soviets, with the help of volunteer workers sent by factories in the towns, got down to rebuilding the villages. The result? Over 861,000 homes built in these past few years. Over 4 million collective farmers moved into them from the dugouts. The problem is not quite solved. There are still 110,000 collective farmers living in dugouts. But that's thousands of where before there were millions. In all the devastated areas in town and countryside, the Germans left 25 million people homeless. But the tail end of the problem is being ironed out fast. 79,000 houses for collective farmers are being built at this very moment, and for those still left over, the foundations will be going in during the next few weeks.